Leslie Jo Eskelson, Representative Eskelson was a member of the House of Representatives for 10 years, first elected in 1954 as a Democrat, served until the election in 1964, and also served then later on as a delegate to the Montana Constitutional Convention. Joe, tell us a little bit about what got you involved in politics to begin with.
Well, when I came home from the service, I was on a minesweeper, and I was like all the rest of young people. I wanted a job, I wanted to get at it, and then the rest of them went to school, but I just went on to the farm. And in a few years, we kind of got interested in politics. As we watched the way our county was run, we decided the old duffers had run their course. So we started running for office. I got elected, I went to Helena, got sworn in 1955, and the session started. In a bit, it was brought to the attention of the legislature that there was a real problem at the in Deer Lodge
at the state penitentiary.
At the penitentiary at Deer Lodge. And so there was a committee appointed to go over there and do an interview job, an investigation. It turned out that committee was of three people.
Was he a legislator?
Yeah.
Pat Gilfeather,
myself, and another representative. I can't remember his name. Anyway, we went to Deer Lodge, and we started to interview the various people. We found out that the Deer Lodge was run by a controller. His job was to make all the decisions. You had the administration, they didn't do anything unless it went through the controller. The guards went through the controller, and the inmates went through the controller. But he turned out to be a person that was looking for trouble. He could irritate you in no time flat.
Now, this wasn't the warden. This was a different guy, huh?
Yeah, this is a different guy.
Okay.
This ain't the warden. The warden had to go through him, too. But anyway, we interviewed him.
And Do you remember what this guy's name was?
I can't think of it. It seems like it was Wright, but I'm not sure. Now, this is 50 years ago. Anyway, as we interviewed him, when we got through interviewing him, we'd pretty well come to the conclusion that we had a person that just had a way of making you angry. So then we interviewed all the guards, or many of the guards, and his name always come up, and that they was never satisfied with him. Then we interviewed the inmates, and they was the same way. In fact, they were the ones that was really disturbed with him. And one of the disturbances was when somebody was eligible for parole, they'd request a hearing. Well, maybe he'd give them one and maybe he wouldn't, never say anything, but it'd be another year before they could request again. Then sometimes he did accept one, he'd interview them, and then turn them down and never say anything. But it's the way he handled it that irritated those people. In interviewing the inmates, we found out that they consider themselves different. One's a criminal and one's an inmate. We wanted to know what the difference was. Well, they said a criminal that's their job. When they get up in the morning, they're going to be a criminal. Then they're going to be in and out of prison all the time. And they liked somebody like this controller because with enough money, you could do about anything. This hit a chord with us.
Yeah.
And then they said the inmate, he's the guy that comes up for parole, and they turn him down. If he gets out, he's never going to come back, probably. Well, anyway, that was our experience. We went back to Helena, and we would give our report to the governor, who was Hugo Aronson at the time. And Hugo was the type of guy that didn't get excited, as a rule. Well, we give our report, and we told him that we thought he should can that guy, move him out in order to avert a riot. Hugo, for whatever reason, didn't. We said of essence, isn't that the way attorneys say it?
Probably.
Hurry up because of an essence of time. Anyway, As it turned out, nothing was done, and we did have a riot.
That riot occurred in 59, I think, didn't it?
Was that when it was?
Yeah, you were in the legislature then.
Oh, yeah, because
I remember the warden's name, I think, was Ellsworth. Does that sound right?
I can't have the slightest idea anymore.
But because the reforms didn't take place, your feeling is that kind of led to that riot in 59.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You couldn't blame Hugo for it, because that was quite a change to can somebody.
Yeah. What should have happened, Joe?
They should have got rid of that guy.
That would have been the main thing, huh?
Main thing.
And he was still there when the riot occurred in 59?
Yeah.
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 It was a guy named Rothy, too, I think. Rothy or Roth, who maybe was the deputy warden. They were both killed, as that runs in my mind, weren't they?
I can't remember, but it turned out to be bloody.
Yeah, it was a bloody deal. Yeah.
So, and...
I was at the... with the high school kids trip to the penitentiary a few years after that occurred, and I remember the fellow who was giving us the tour of the prison showed us the bazooka hole in the two main ringleaders of the guy named Smart, I think. Forgotten what the other guy's name was, but they were holed up in a tower, kind of a high place there in the old bastille of a prison. And the National Guardsmen there came and bazooka'd that thing, and that's how they got him, I guess.
Yeah. I can't remember who the inmates were killed, but there was a couple of them killed.
Yeah.
And well, anyway, that's the story of Deer Lodge.
Now, you ran for the legislature as a Democrat.
Yeah.
That was during the period, I think, well, Franklin D. Roosevelt had been president when you were a kid, mm-hmm. and Truman, of course, was president right after the war. And presumably those men were models to you. Why were you a Democrat?
Why was I a Democrat? I'm a Democrat because the county was run by Republicans, and I thought they took advantage of everything and all the hiring and firing.
And that it was time for a change.
Time for a change. And
so your reasons weren't so deeply philosophical, although you must have. I suppose you generally voted for Democratic candidates for president, that type of thing?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I was that type of... At that time, the Democrats were for reservoirs or dams, and the power company was opposed, and this all made the discussion go.
And of course, it's somewhat different now, I think, isn't it?
Completely reversed.
Yeah.
We couldn't build dams or reservoirs because of the Montana Power Company and the power that they had.
Yeah.
Today, they couldn't build a reservoir if they wanted to because of the environmental movement.
Yeah.
So this whole thing, and at that time, and I still believe that water is more important than gas. Is 50 years from now, you can still be making gas or something to burn, but making water might be pretty difficult.
Yeah.
And as the population increases, it's going to get more difficult.
Joe, were there a couple of three, maybe more than that, but a few legislators, Democrats and or Republicans, that kind of stand out in your mind back in the 50s and early 60s when you were a legislator?
Well, Melcher was in there, and Melcher was a real tidy guy. Kept everything just where it was supposed to.
He had a very clean and neat desk.
Yeah, there you are. And we were... Virginia brought the daughter. We had a new little daughter, Loy, and Virginia brought Loy up there, and she wanted to come sit on my lap, so I let her. And while she's sitting there, all of a sudden she scooted off, run over to Melcher's desk. He's sitting on the end seat, and started throwing the papers around. And I got over there. I got over there to have her stop. He says, "Leave her go. It's the most fun I've had since I've been here."
Well, good.
Well, I have a story about Tony Roselle.
Great.
And we served on the administrations committee, state administrations committee together. And she had a couple bills in there pertaining to attorney or to lawyers or to judges, I mean. And so this day, why her bill come up, but on second reading, she made the motion to approve it and so forth and give the speech, and then the attorney started in on her. And first one would get her, and then another one would get her, and they just hammered her right down.
Huh.
And all she could do is sit there and take it until they were all through, and then she could close. So I went to see Tony, and I said, Antoinette, the next time you bring that other judge's bill up, well, as soon as the first attorney gets through talking, I'll get up and get permission to ask you a question. And then you go, you got all the time you want to answer that. And then when the next one gets up, we'll do the same thing. And we'll do it until they get tired. And it won't take very long because they lose popularity fast, attorneys.
Sure. Yeah.
Anyway, I found out that there was two different people in the legislature. One was attorneys, and the other was legislator of the Hoi Polloi. See? And so the once she did that, well, she passed her bill. So we became friends.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And I always worked with Antoinette on state administration's committee.
I had a one of these same interviews, Joe, with her day before yesterday in Billings, and had a good visit with her. Do you remember Francis Bardineau, certainly?
Oh, of course. He come in as one session after I'd been there. It took him one session to find out what was going on. And then the next session he was there, when they come in for the same boiler that they'd put in for the year before, he remembered.
Huh.
And when they come in for another 25 typewriters, he remembered.
Yeah.
So bureaucrats right away found that they'd met their match. And he was probably, the Republicans and Democrats are called conservatives and liberal, but he was probably the most conservative person that there ever was in that.
When it came to money.
When it come to money.
Managing money, yeah.
He was always on the Appropriation Committee. And by the way, I'd made up my mind after I'd been to a session or two that if you was ever going to accomplish anything, you had to be on the Appropriations Committee and the State Administration.
Yeah.
Because if you wasn't, the bureaucrats would just ignore you.
You remember, now of course, Ted Schwinden was a legislator.
Yes, and we were great friends. And
would you have predicted that Ted would have gone on to be governor?
Not particularly, but...
How would you have described him as a legislator?
Oh, he was capable. He was an educated person. He could handle himself. You know, I got out of high school, and that was about it, so I wasn't all that great. But Ted and Bardineau now... of course, he read a lot, so he was well acquainted.
Now, Joe, you're unique, too, in the respect that you served in the legislature with Melcher, who went on to become a U.S. Senator.
Yes.
You served with Tim Babcock, who went on to become governor.
Yeah.
Tom Judge, who went on to become governor.
Yes.
Ted Schwinden, I think in about the 59 session, I think Babcock and Schwinden were both there, I think. I guess Judge didn't come until a couple years later. How would you compare them, those three, as legislators? All of them became governor.
Well, they all had their way of doing things. I had my way of doing it, too. And I did it through the appropriations. They did it through the pull they had. You know, and they were powerful individuals.
Was Babcock a legislator who, if he had never been elected governor, would he have been memorable? Or Schwinden, or...
Oh, I would have never forgot those guys there.
Yeah.
There's a lot of them that was in the legislature. I haven't the slightest idea. In fact, some of the committees I was on, I don't remember any of the people who was on it.
Yeah. What was it about Babcock that would have been memorable to you?
Well, I got a little story there. And that goes to the National Guards. It was Malta's turn to get a new armory. And in second place was Glasgow. There was going to be two. So one day, they're bringing this up in the Senate. And somebody came forward and told me, said, "Do you know that McAway amended Malta out and put Deer Lodge in?"
Who did?
McAway.
Oh, Joe McElwain was a state representative from Deer Lodge.
Deer Lodge.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think he later went on to be president of the Montana Power Company.
Well, yeah. So you can see the caliber of guys that I'm confronted with. And anyway, they decided that they'd just amend Malta out and put Deer Lodge in. Well, when I found that out, I was sitting in my seat thinking a little, and Bardenau come by, and he said, "What are you going to do, Joe?" I said, "I don't know." I said, "But let's go to the governor's office." So we went down there, and on the way, I thought, "Well, I know what we'll do." So I said, "Francis, before we go in, get yourself all emotional." And so we rushed in that office. I said, "Ma'am, there's a big flood taking place in Blaine and in Phillips County. I need to get a hold of the Adjutant General immediately." She grabbed the phone and handed it. I said, "I got you. I want you to up to the House chambers in 15 minutes. See, he was hiding from me, so I couldn't find him. You couldn't do anything unless I could find him.
Oh, sure.
Sure. And so I got him at my desk, and I said, "This is the way it's going to be. If you take Malta out of this, as long as my butt points down, you'll never get another army in Montana. As long as I'm on appropriation, you ain't going to do it to me." About 30 minutes while he come back, and he said, "There'll be three armories, one in Malta, one in Glasgow, and one in Deer Lodge."
I see. Wow.
So did you want to know if I knew Tim Babcock? Sure I did. I respected him.
Now, how was Tim involved in that, Joe?
Nutter got killed.
Yeah, I know.
And Tim became governor.
Yeah.
Well, he was a governor.
Okay.
Well, they're all in cahoots together.
Okay.
Yeah. They all knew what they were doing. The Adjutant General surely talked to the governor.
I see. Did you ever meet Governor Babcock personally as a legislator? Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, I met him all, yeah. And I liked his wife, Betty. She was in the Constitution.
In the Congress together.
Yeah.
How about Tom Judge?
Oh, I like Tom. He appointed me to the Veterans Affairs Division. I served on that for 15 years.
How was he as a you described Schwinnen as very smart, very capable as a legislator, and I imagine he presented himself well on the floor.
Oh, always, yeah.
How would you have described Tom Judge?
Well, Tom was ambitious, and he was aggressive. He was younger, so he had a little tougher row to hoe, but he managed to get elected.
Would you have predicted that he would have gone on to greater things?
Well, I don't know if I would have or not.
Yeah.
I'm sure he had the ability to go on, you know,
yeah.
And he was in the political position to go on.
Yeah.
But
let me mention a couple of other names to you. Just these men never went on to beyond the legislature, as far as I know. Dale McGarvey.
Oh yeah, he's from Flathead.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah. He was a dedicated person that was for reservoirs,
yeah.
Dams,
yeah.
And in that area, that was important to them.
When I started this project, one of the things that I was especially interested in was to better understand the power and the influence of the Anaconda Company. And the Anaconda Company probably had cast a larger shadow in the state, maybe in the 30s and 40s, than they did when you got there. But you were there when they still were, a pretty important force to be reckoned with.
Oh, if they wanted it, they got it. If they didn't want it, they didn't get it.
How did they do that?
Well, they did it real easy. They gathered up the Republican Party. And in gathering up the Republican Party and a delegation out of Butte and Anaconda, they generated enough votes. They never won by much, but they always won by one or two votes. And that's the way it was.
Did they? Did you ever have any contact with anybody from the Anaconda Company?
Well, I knew them all as lobbyists. I can't name them right now.
Wilkinson?
Oh, I'm sure. I
Danny Shea or Billy
Gray? Oh, Shea, yeah.
Yeah.
But I can't remember too many more. There were even then there was a lot of lobbyists around Alma.
What did they want? I mean, when they wanted things, they got them. What was their position generally? I mean, was there a?
Well, usually they didn't want to strengthen the unions. They didn't want to pay more taxes than they needed to, and which is natural.
Yeah.
They throwed in with the Montana Power Company. And
you saw them as working pretty closely together.
Oh, they were in the same bed until Anaconda Company went to the Montana Power Company to get a rate reduction. And when the power company wouldn't give it to them, that's when the split took place.
And that happened when?
Oh,
when you were there?
I think I was gone then.
I see.
Yeah.
Do you remember a legislator from Butte by the name of Mervyn Dempsey?
I do. I remember the name. I knew Ray Wernon better. We were friends.
And would he have been typical of the Butte legislators?
Pretty much, as I recall.
So
they all stuck together.
Stuck together and generally supported the position of the Anaconda Company?
And the power company.
And
that's where Montana Power lived, was in Butte.
Yeah.
And they would have been crazy not to.
You remember a legislator named Jake Frank?
No, I can't place him.
Fred Broder?
Broder, I remember, yeah. Broder, let's see. I remember, was he from Helena?
No, he was from the Flathead.
Flathead, oh, yeah, okay. But I can't tell you if he's a Democrat or Republican.
John McDonald?
Real well. He was a Speaker of the House. That was my first experience, was the election of John McDonald.
Tell me about that.
Well, I was new, and I went there, and I was impressed with John. His opponent was Fred Barrett from, he was from
Chester, I think, yeah.
Yeah. And I supported John, and I suppose that's one reason I ended up on the administration committee. I think I was chairman of that in my first session.
Oh, really? Wow.
I think so.
Yeah.
I was chairman of it off and on whenever we were in the majority.
Gene Mahoney?
Oh, yeah.
He was speaker, I think, while you were there, wasn't he?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Run into Gene Mahoney one time over in Kona, Hawaii. The other little island. I haven't got the right one.
Maui?
Maui, yeah. He was sitting in a little shack there drinking a beer.
Now, when you were there, the Anaconda Company and I think other interests in Montana had what they called watering holes?
Oh, always. Yeah.
What do you remember about those? Those were gone by the time I got to the legislature.
Yeah. Well, they were good hosts, and you didn't have to talk to them if you didn't want to, or you didn't have to talk. They didn't make you talk about what they wanted particularly. She was there to enjoy herself. And they'd take us over to Butte to eat over at, was it Dorothy's or Mary's? Or
Lydia's? Okay.
Lydia's.
Sure. Yeah.
And they put on a feed for everybody. They brought the whole Senate and the House, the whole shebang, if you wanted to go. And everybody went, because this was quite an occasion to all be together, you know.
Yeah. And the watering holes were a gathering place that occurred at the end of the day during legislative sessions?
Not during the sessions. It was always after.
That's what I mean, at the end of the legislative day.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, I think that there was more than one, but they were... More than one of them in the Placer Hotel?
Well, that's where they usually held them then.
Yeah.
See it, and then, yeah, that's where they were. The Jorgensen's, that's where a lot of people went. And
the Jorgensen's was a bar and restaurant nearer the Capitol building.
Yeah.
And a little newer than
the and then there was a town organization, a bankers club.
Okay.
Club?
Yeah, the Montana Club.
Montana Club.
That's where the big parties were.
Yeah, that's
where
the other parties were held. Yeah.
Yeah. So, do you have a recollection of the Anaconda Company watering hole? I mean, was it?
Can I remember going to it?
Yeah, I'm
not
just
really.
Just
I can't.
Describe
but
what it was like.
Well, it was just a lot of people in there with all kinds of hors d'oeuvres and booze.
I see. Just a hospitality room with comfortable furniture, large room at the Placer
Hotel.
Yeah,
as I look back on it,
yeah.
They didn't try to change your mind there. They did it just because of their friendliness, you know.
Of their what?
Being friendly.
I see.
They always spoke to you, and they was always friendly.
Yeah.
And if you wanted to talk to them about something, why, you could ask them.
So from our conversation, Joe, I don't get the impression that you have really a bad feeling toward them. You felt independent of them. You didn't feel like you...
Well, absolutely.
You felt totally independent of them, but you didn't really... You don't really have a feeling of anger or anything toward them as you look back.
I thought that they kind of run roughshod over us once in a while. But that was politics, you know. But now, the Montana Power Company, as I look back now, It was quite a company. They paid their administrators, they paid their help real well. They always paid a dividend, and we had a fair electrical rate. And when you look at all of that, and what they were for was not to get charged more taxes, and so the big fight in taxes was that they was appraised at a certain value for taxation purposes. They was appraised at another value for income. The higher appraisal they had for all everything was the more income they got. So the two never matched.
Oh.
And this was where the dissension come in.
I see.
And so as a Democrat, why, that was bad.
Yeah. And so Democrats generally favored changing the tax laws in a way that you felt would be more fair as far as
yeah,
they were concerned.
Yeah.
And of course they fought that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was where the fight was.
Yeah.
And I suppose they were satisfied with one little fight a session yelled.
But in your experience there, they generally won?
Oh, they always won.
But you were there sometimes when the Democrats were in the majority.
Oh, yeah.
But they won anyway.
Oh, yeah. You always had enough from Anaconda and Butte to do it. See? That's where their bread and butter was.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you generally, when you were there, you felt that you generally aligned yourself with the folks who weren't part of that their voting bloc.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've asked you a little bit about these governors that you served with in the legislature, but you also served in the House when Don Nutter was a member of the state Senate, and then of course when Nutter was governor in '61. Any impressions of him?
Well, I didn't agree with Don. And the reason I didn't agree with him because he was very conservative, and we actually like one Department of Labor, cut their budget down to where it paid the guy's wages. He had to bum stamps, bum rides. You learn this after the session's over. But Nutter was trying to hold the cost of government down.
Yeah.
And he was dedicated to do that. And so there was in my opinion, it took several years to overcome that, to get back where people were paid and so forth.
You felt that Nutter maybe overdid that?
Overdid that, yes.
Too far in the direction of economy and government?
Yeah.
Did you support taxes then to try to raise more money for government?
I'm glad you asked that. Because there was two departments in Montana, agriculture and state lands. Lowell Purdy and Tegan.
I think Lowell Purdy was the Commissioner of Agriculture at that time. Yeah.
And if he was from Alden, I knew Lowell real. And then the Commissioner of State Lands. Anyway, they come to me on the subcommittee on appropriations. I was the chairman, and we handled all the boards and bureaus and the university system in the state of Montana. So when these two gentlemen come to me, they were getting $7,000 a year to be the head of those departments. And things was changing, and they wanted more money. And I said, well, gentlemen, tell me what you want. Tell me what you think you should get. And so we settled on $3,000 a piece raise. So they now mm-hmm. getting $10,000. And the same thing happened to the courts, Montana's courts.
The judges wanted more money.
They wanted more money. And I agreed with them that I thought they was entitled to some more money. So we give them some more money. Then when we come to the campaign, what do you think that stood on the roster up there with 2,500 people listening about me? I was a taxer and a spender.
Who said this about you?
That's what these guys. That's what Purdy and and Teagan or whatever his name
was. Teagan.
Mons Teagan.
Yeah.
Got up and said that I was a taxer and a spender.
After
I'd done that to
him. Stuck out your neck to get a raise for him. That happened right here in Malta?
Right here in Malta. We had two big jamborees here. The Democrats had one with about 2,500, and so the Republicans. But anyway, I handled their budget again the next year. So when I wrote in, I just wrote in $10,000 for what they was going to get. And man, they come down there and they was wild. I said, "Fellas, you said I was a taxer and a spender. I'm going to cut down."
They wrote in $10,000, or that gave them a raise, didn't it?
No, they got a raise of $3,000. They was getting $7,000
a year. I got
you.
Yeah.
We give them a raise to $3,000.
To ten. You jacked them up to
$10,000.
Yeah.
So when they come the second year to get, and they wanted more than that $10,000.
Oh, they wanted more than the ten.
Oh, absolutely, they want another raise.
I see.
And I just said, "Well, I'm a taxer and a spender. You ain't going to get it." I said, and I want to know why they did that to me. I said, "You didn't have to say anything. You know, that was a terrible thing to do to me." That's politics.
Yeah, that's politics. Oh, that's an interesting story.
Well, that's the same way it was politics when I handled their budget, too.
Yeah. Well, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now, so did you ever meet Nutter?
Well, I don't, other than he come to the sessions and stuff, I don't know if I ever did or not.
Actually,
I don't know if I'd talked to him or not. I probably had, because I talked to everybody.
Did you know Arnold Olson?
Oh, yeah, real well. Yeah. He was his own worst enemy. You know, he got beat because he come here, and I said, now this is right at the beginning of my political career. I said, "Arnold, don't say anything about," I think he was running against Hugo, wasn't he?
Probably for governor in 56,
Yeah. I said, "Just leave him alone. Just tell what you're going to do. Don't even mention him." He got up there and just ripped right into Hugo. And that crowd wasn't, they wasn't fit for that.
Yeah.
And I know that he lost them right there.
Yeah. Because Hugo was personally popular here.
Oh, yeah, he was popular, bet.
Yeah. What was the basis for Hugo's popularity?
Oh, he just, Hugo. He just did his thing.
He was personable and...
Yeah, he was personable and he was easy to talk to and he was a happy-go-lucky guy. And he didn't pretend to be the valedictorian of any class or anything. He just run the show.
So you continued in the legislature for 10 years.
Yeah.
And then were you defeated in 64 or just didn't run again?
No, I was elected in 64, but I was indeed defeated the next session.
Defeated in 66?
Yeah.
Was there an issue?
Oh, yeah. Johnson. President Johnson got in trouble.
Okay.
And the Republicans put on a real move. And this is a Republican county here, pretty strong. And that's what had happened.
So you just kind of went down in a landslide. The Republicans had a good year.
They had a good year, and it finally took me out,
So there wasn't any particular issue, any state issue or anything like that, huh?
No. I don't think that wasn't the problem.
Yeah. Who was your opponent in that election?
Louis Perry.
Okay, and I remember him. I served with him too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you were out of elective office for a few years. Were you active in any organization, any farm organization, grain growers or Farm Bureau, or Farmers Union, or anything?
No, I was too busy for that. But I was involved in the veterans movement.
Okay,
in
veterans organizations. Yeah, and you mentioned the governor judge, I think, appointed you.
Yeah, appointed me, and so did Anderson.
Yeah. Okay.
And I served. It would have been 16 years, but when Swindon was governor, an opening came, and he appointed a lady. And at that time, there was three VFW members, and one Legion, and this. Lady, and she replaced the Legion, and I became concerned about that because I wanted the Legion to have somebody on the committee. I went to the governor and I told him, I said, if you'll appoint the gentleman from Chester, I can't think of his name right now, a Legion personnel, if you'll, and he was a leader in the organization, if you'll appoint him, I'll resign. And so we'll have a Legion member on this committee. So he agreed to it, and that's what happened.
I see.
So I only served 15 years instead of 16.
And I want to ask you too. I want to ask you about your involvement in the Constitutional Convention and some of your experiences there. Also, want to ask you about Senator Mansfield and Senator Metcalf and so on.
Yeah, don't forget them.
Well, let's do that now. What's your recollection of Senator Mansfield?
Well, I've had opportunity to visit him many times throughout the year. The first time I met him was in Helena. It was a big Democrat rally. And we went into a show house, I think.
Probably the old Marlowe Theater?
Probably, yeah. I think that's right. And Senator Mansfield stood at the entrance and met every person as we went in and shook our hands and got our names. When the whole thing was over, he come and stood in the same spot and he shook everybody's hand and gave everybody's name on the way out.
Isn't that amazing?
It's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable, yeah.
But he never forgot a name and he never... In my case, he'd ask how Virginia was and how my mother was. See?
Yeah.
You know, he never forgot anything.
Yeah. It was really astounding. I had a similar experience with him, too.
Mm-hmm.
You could meet him even years later, and he'd remember who you were. Yeah.
Oh, yes. And never forgot. I dealt with Metcalf quite a little bit.
Anything else about Mansfield before we... That's
well, he was... He had a principle about him that... There wasn't any back cutting. There wasn't no character assassination. He was proud of the Senate. And while he was majority leader of the Senate, the senators, everyone was treated just like the other one. There was no specials. And he seen to it that if they was trying to get something on to go, he'd help them. He'd make it so it could work.
But you had visits with him personally. Too.
Oh,
you
yes.
Knew him on a one-on-one basis.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Did you ever discuss, like, an issue with him that affected your area back in Washington, D.C., or anything like that? Or?
Well, I did. As it happened, I was kind of the leading Democrat here, okay? I was expected to find a few jobs. But by the time I could find out that somebody was leaving... The Republicans already knew it. They already had the place filled before I found out that was happening. So one time back in Washington, D.C., talking to Mansfield, I told him that I wasn't having very good... Well, he said, have you got somebody that you want to give jobs to? You know, I said, yes, I had two guys to work for the BLM. He said, fine. He said, when do you want to do this? Said, well, now it's fine. You know, getting around in Washington wasn't the easiest thing for me. So he said, Stanley, you do get this. He got the heads of all of the departments.
Who's Stanley?
Kimmets.
Oh, Stan Kimmets, okay.
Sure.
Who was the Secretary of the Senate and later on, I think, perhaps not then. Okay.
Well, Bobby Baker was first. And
yeah,
then,
sure.
And then Kimmets, see.
Yeah.
But anyway, Kimmets got the head of all of the various, the Forest Service, the BLM, the... You just keep naming them, all of those. And went down there, and there was one chair there. He said, there's your chair. Here's the people you're going to talk to. And
wow.
You know, the heads of all the departments. So I told him, I said, these are the two guys I'm trying to get on. And they're going to be filled with Republicans. And I want them hired. And they said, fine. So I went home and went... to Mansfield. Mansfield, when you get home, you put their names in. If they don't get hired, you tell the guy that's running the outfit to call so-and-so in Billings. I come home, I went to him, he laughed at me. I picked up his phone, I called the person in Billings. Next day, this guy's on his way to Billings. The next day, these two guys are hired.
Who was president at the time, do you remember?
gosh.
Would it have been during Johnson's term in office? Was this while you were a legislator?
No, this was it. No, no, I was a legislator. Metcalf's the one that did it for me, too.
Well, it could have been, if it was before 1960, Eisenhower was president, but afterwards it would have been Kennedy or Johnson, I imagine.
Could have been, I can't remember.
Because you'd think Mansfield would have had more influence in a Democratic administration back there. But you've mentioned that the jobs were going to be filled by Republicans here locally, and I'm just
well, this
curious.
Is the Republican county.
Yeah.
So in order to get a job, you had to do something.
Yeah.
Right. And the Democrats took it over for a number of years.
Yeah.
But I'll say one thing for you Republicans, you never quit. and they never quit. And today, there isn't a Democrat elected in this county.
Here in Phillips County.
Phillips County.
Yeah.
That's because of the hard work.
Yeah.
And they never quit.
Yeah. But Mansfield, working with Stan Kimmett, helped to get you in touch with some important bureaucrats back in Washington, D.C. that made it possible for you to hire a couple of local Democrats to the BLM here in this area. And he was obviously the guy that made it happen. How about Metcalf?
Well, he got a job for me for a lady on the Bowdoin Refuge, and Metcalf did it. Now, Metcalf also, for my sister who worked for the ASCS office in Shodo, and at that time, many years ago, women weren't supposed to be in charge of anything. And she was in charge of the ASCS office there in Shodo. And so some of the old redneck farmers decided to get rid of her. And I got a hold of Metcalf, and between Metcalf and my sister, she retained her job.
I see. Yeah.
But it was because of the good old boys theory.
Now, did you ever have a chance to have a conversation with Metcalf?
Oh, yeah, I talked to him. In fact, we lived in his house during one session.
Oh, really? His house there in Helena?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was probably the house in which he died.
Could be.
He died in his house there in Helena, just a couple blocks down the hill from the Capitol.
Yeah, I used to walk to the Capitol.
Yeah. Huh. So you knew him quite well, obviously.
Oh, real well.
He was your landlord.
That's right.
How would you describe him?
Well, he was a dedicated senator. When he took in after something, he never quit. He was capable. And to me, he was very personal.
He was a personable around
you. Yeah, he was a kind of a guy that you liked, you know.
Yeah. He had a reputation for having a temper. Did you ever see any of that?
No, I didn't. But I probably wasn't one that was irritating.
And then, of course, Donna Metcalf, his wife, you knew her too.
Yeah, some.
Yeah.
But not so much.
Yeah. How did it happen that you rented his house?
Oh, that goes to the telephone company. Telephone company said, "We got just the right house for you." They'd got it from Metcalf, see?
The telephone company?
Yeah, they had a set of lobbyists or just as smooth as a power company.
Yeah.
And I was well acquainted with him. And
so you were coming to Helena, I suppose you'd been there before?
Yeah, sessions before.
And you needed the house, so there was Al Riegel their lobbyist then?
You're right, huh? Yeah, that's who it was.
Al. So you got in touch with Al Riegel, and he said, "Do you need a house, Joe?" And you said, "Yeah, what do you got?"
He called me.
Well,
he said, "We got the house for you."
Yeah.
He took the initiative.
I see.
He liked to hunt ducks and stuff.
Yeah.
So it would take him out on the place and he'd hunt ducks. I wouldn't need a duck if you give me a duck.
But he had befriended you as lobbyist sometimes.
As a lobbyist, And most of those lobbyists were very personal, you know.
And so Riegel knew that Metcalf's house was for rent.
Sure.
Do you suppose Metcalf talked to Riegel about that, or do you suppose he just...
Oh, I imagine Riegel approached him.
I see.
In fact, they've done this for 100 years,
yeah.
So they knew every house was available in the whole outfit.
Yeah. So you didn't deal directly with Metcalf; you dealt through Riegel to get your house.
Yeah, that's right. But I met every time we went back to Washington D.C. Well, we went to whoever was there.
Yeah, sure.
Mansfield and Metcalf, and whether it was Anderson or whether it was Murley or Williams or Wood.
What can you tell me about Senator Jim Murray?
Well, this is, I think when the first time I went to Washington, I met Jim. It couldn't have been too, I couldn't have met him too many times. I'm really sorry that I didn't get my picture taken with him.
Yeah.
Because,
you were an admirer of his.
Well, yeah, I appreciated the fact that he was a United States Senator.
Yeah. Now, you were first elected in 54.
Yeah.
And he had a tough re-election campaign. A congressman by the name of Wes Dewart ran against him in 54.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a battle on his hands, and that was his last term in office. You were probably running your own campaign then. Do you remember anything about that campaign between Dewart and Murray?
No, not really. I wasn't just personally involved in it. He was a Democrat, so I'd have been supporting him, but otherwise.
What do you remember about General Leroy Anderson, Congressman Anderson?
Yeah, Anderson. Well,
he
made a mistake because he moved in. He was going to be something else. Instead of running for Congress, he ran for something else.
Well, yeah, he and Lee Metcalf ran against each other in the Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate to take over for Murray in 1960.
Yeah, now that's the reason I'd forgotten about that, but I know Anderson ended up back on the farm.
Yeah, that's right. And it sounds like from, you don't remember it, but perhaps you were more favorable to Metcalf than Anderson in that primary?
Oh, I'm sure I was, but that's a long time ago.
What do you remember about Congressman Orvin Fiore?
I was going to ask you about it. When we named Batten and Smiley, now there was a Smiley that was elected to Congress.
Well, he ran. He didn't quite make it. He ran against Arnold Olson. He was a legislator from Bozeman. Dick Smiley was his name.
He didn't get elected.
Didn't quite make it. But he ran against Arnold Olson. And, I think he came close. That would have been in the Western District.
I was more impressed with Smiley and Batten. Batten went on to be a congressman, as I recall, and then now he's a judge.
You served in the legislature with Batten.
And he was a. They were the kind of people that you like to know. In other words, they wasn't backbiting or anything, and just good ordinary people.
Yeah, that's how you felt about Batten.
Did you
visit with him when you were ever in Washington D.C. after you got to Congress?
Oh yeah, I'm sure that if we look in my wall there, we'll find his picture.
Really?
Yeah. Okay.
So you had generally a good opinion of him.
Yeah. The only picture that I didn't get was Murray's.
Yeah.
You know, from the time that this started.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mansfield, Metcalf, Melcher, Batten,
Arnold Olson. Yeah.
You just keep naming them.
So you remained out of politics for a few years, from about 1964 to 1972. Is that right? Except for your involvement in Veterans Affairs.
Yeah.
And then you ran for the Constitutional Convention.
Yes.
Is there a story about that?
Well, Lee Robinson, you know him.
A rancher here in this area.
Well, he had that big building on it just you come into town.
Okay.
And I just talked to him day before yesterday. He had some kind of a virus, and he was on an air.
Yeah.
He was one of the candidates, and
he's a pretty active Republican, isn't he?
Oh yeah. And I think he gets disgusted with him once in a while.
Now his father was Fred Robinson.
Fred Robinson. He was a senator when I was in the House.
Yeah. Okay.
And
he cast a pretty big shadow here.
He did.
Montana, too, didn't he?
The only thing he ever said about me is he's a dangerous little boy.
Is that right?
Oh, they had tricks. But anyway.
Would you have thought he might have been close to the Anaconda Company, for example, in the work that they did here?
Well, it's like the governor said, I'm a lap child.
Yeah.
Well, that's what Fred was. He was their lead man.
He was the lead man for the Anaconda Company in the legislature?
And the power company. He was a big supporter.
Yeah.
So that was hard to overcome, you know.
Yeah.
And he'd served many years. He got beat, though, one session.
Huh.
Yeah, Mrs. Phillips ran against him.
Huh.
And he said, you don't have to pay any attention to me. You vote for Watkins. Be sure to vote for Watkins. When the vote was taken, they didn't vote for him. And she got elected.
Uh-oh.
Oh.
Who was Watkins?
He was a legislator.
I see.
This was
before you served, right?
Before I served, yeah.
In the 30s or 40s or something?
Oh, I don't know just when he would have been. Probably just a session or two before me.
Yeah.
Listen, I can't remember all of it.
Well, Joe, tell us about the Con-Con.
Okay.
Why did you run for the Con-Con? Lee Robinson was running, Fred Robinson's son.
Yeah.
And you felt he wouldn't be very good? Or?
No. I wasn't really excited about the Constitutional Convention. I thought that the legislature could amend the Constitution for the three or four places that could use some help.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, so I run for it. And Marion Waters was another candidate. And from Saco, Virginia, Lloyd Barnard he was also...
He had been a legislator at the time, hadn't he?
Yeah. Now, when they lined this all up for the Constitutional Convention, they made it so that you had, if you was in politics, you couldn't run. In other words,
if you were holding an office, you couldn't run
for that.
Yeah.
So, but they couldn't keep us from running. Well, anyway, I got elected. And there's a difference between the Constitution, the makeup of the Constitution, what they do, and what the legislature does. In the legislature, the first thing they ask you is how much the taxes are, what the appropriation is, and who's going to get the money. That's what the legislature does.
Yeah.
Look after that type. See who gets the money and how they spend it. The Constitution, that was just to set down the rules you should live by.
Yeah.
So they, and the, you know, the delegates to the Constitution were probably the greatest bunch you could ever put together. They were dedicated, they were educated, they were scattered over the whole state. They was young and they was old and they was men and women. They set us in alphabetical order to keep us from being political.
Was that good?
I suppose it was.
Yeah.
I sat next to her, Marion Erdman, and next to her, Dorothy Eck.
Okay.
And I had a post on the side, and Dorothy Bugsby in front of me. Anyway, in the Constitution, like I say, they wasn't interested in what these things might do. They knew what they wanted done. And where they lost me was in the appraisal of all properties. They changed it from the county commissioners. They stripped the county commissioners and put it within the state. And I was certain.
So the appraisal of property was handled by the State Department of Revenue rather than by the local county officials.
County commissioners.
Yeah.
And in thinking this over, I was certain that when you take thousands of pieces of personal property and move it from the counties to the state, that it was going to involve a lot of work. I could see millions of dollars going into this thing. And by the way, it cost millions, and it still costs millions. And 30 years later, they still don't have it quite right, because there's still that 2% deal.
Yeah. Now, Joe, what was the reason for that? Why did the Con-Con feel it was necessary to take the appraisal power away from the locally elected people?
They didn't think the counties could do it. They wasn't sure.
Well, of course, the county had been doing it.
Yeah, but they wasn't sure that between the counties it was the same,
okay.
And they were going to make it the same. This could.
But it was an equalization problem.
That's what they.
Weren't there also questions of maybe some dishonesty?
Well, it could be, but that, you know, that would have corrected itself if the state could have been the ones between the counties, and they could have investigated the counties and straightened the counties out, and then they could have raised the counties up or down so that they end up being the same over the state of Montana.
Yeah.
But I could see millions of dollars being spent in this thing, and if you was... I looked it up one time. It looked like it was $16 million for a year's appraisal, but I could be wrong on that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then the next thing that happened was the water rights. Now, this is the same kind of a situation. You take the water rights from the county, which there's thousands of them, move them to Helena one at a time is going to cost millions of dollars. They've been over 30 years at it. They're only half done, and they haven't even entered into the lawsuits yet. This is going to be a very expensive venture.
How did the Constitution, how did it affect water rights?
How did it affect them before the water rights are kept locally?
So it was just as simple as that.
It was just as simple. I had to change one word, put it in the state.
I got you. I see.
And
but they have to all be refiled, and I'm not even sure I understand the process. Readjudicated or something?
Readjudicated. You had to take my water rights. I finally met with somebody in Haver, I think it was. And we went all through all the water rights. This takes in underground wells, dams, and puddles, and rivers, and the streams, and so forth. The state claimed it all.
Was the thinking that sometimes water crosses a boundary, a county boundary, and that would be better off if it was a central location? If you might have water rights in more than one county or something.
Oh, you could have that, but. They was in the counties that you were in.
Yeah.
If you want to know who's right, what person had what rights, you go to the county and look them up.
Yeah.
Tell you. But in that moving process, you can see that each one had to be handled singularly. It wasn't something you could bunch in.
Yeah.
So, like I say, this has been going on 30 years.
Yeah.
And it's still...
I know it's been a problem for a long time. I'm aware of it, too. I guess I've never really understood exactly what the problem is. It isn't just a matter of physically taking some water rights on paper from the courthouse, making copies of them, and sending them to the state.
Well, except they gotta adjudicate it. They have to get an agreement from everybody. In other words, they had to personally interview me.
Oh.
Because they couldn't just take those water rights and mess and screw around with them without getting the persons involved with it. So this was a real problem for me in the convention.
Yeah.
Now, one other thing that was bothered me, and that's the Board of Regents. We used to have three parts of government.
Yeah.
Judiciary, legislative, executive.
Yeah.
Now we now got four parts. Yeah. The Board of Regents, the only difference is the Board of Regents is appointed, not elected.
Yeah.
And they have all kinds of authority.
Yeah.
And we're still suffering from that.
And as a legislator on the Appropriations Committee, you'd remember that. That's why that was a red flag to you. I know, I shouldn't say I know this, but my recollection is that Francis Bardineau was concerned about that same provision. Do you remember that?
Oh, I can't necessarily remember it now, but he was.
Yeah.
He picked that stuff all up, you know.
Yeah. I think he had the same concern you did about that. And when Roscoe was governor, Roscoe attempted to curtail the power of the Board of Regents. And Roscoe's, remember his argument was that if the elected officials have to raise the taxes and appropriate the money for the university system, if they're accountable for it, then when the legislature goes home and the money is turned over to the Board of Regents, they resented as well as he the idea that the regents would say, well, we're not going to give quite as much money to Western as the legislature decided to do, we're going to give more of it to Northern or whatever. And it was his idea, look, they shouldn't be able to do that. They weren't elected.
Yeah.
They don't have they don't need to be accountable for this.
Yeah. You know,
but there was an attempt to amend the state constitution to do that, and that when it was voted down.
That it's surprising what happens, what makes different bedfellows.
Yeah.
one time you're some of the legislation against them, and the next time, you're completely opposite. I was going to show you the... let's see, what was I going to talk about?
You're going to show me something? What were you going to show me?
I was going to... Yeah.
Just tell me.
Tell you?
Yeah.
Well, I was going to show you how the vote was set up.
Oh, in the Constitutional Convention?
Yeah. Here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is what was on the ballot. Yeah.
Yeah. Now,
because now, Joe, I think you were a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, but you had enough concerns about it, the ones you just mentioned to me, that when the convention concluded, you decided probably it wouldn't be a good idea to have it be confirmed. So you were one of a handful of delegates who opposed the ratification of the Constitution. Is that correct?
I signed it, The reason I signed it is because I agreed to most of it, see?
Yeah.
And I wasn't trying to kill the thing. Oh.
But you, what was your position when it went on the ballot?
Went on the ballot there?
Yeah. Did you vote for or against ratifying the Constitution?
Well, you mean what I voted at home?
Yeah.
I voted against it.
Okay. And you kind of talked against it, didn't
you?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was trying to find the news release I had.
Did you give reasons for being against it? Well, that's what you're going to show me here?
Yeah.
Well, this was your news release.
Yeah.
Statement by Leslie Jo Eskelson, Vice Chairman of the Rules Committee and Floor Manager. We delegates to the Constitutional Convention agree to present to the new Constitution the people objectively, neither selling it nor defeating it, and let the voters make up their own minds about it. Due to recent action by some delegates the past weeks to form truth troops to go out and hard sell the new proposed Constitution, I feel no longer obligated to any earlier agreement. If the new Constitution was indeed the fine document that some people would have the electorate believe it is, that people would have such an automatic and spontaneous enthusiasm about it that it would pass entirely on its own merits. However, this hasn't happened. The reason being, there is nothing in the document to inspire their enthusiasm, and there really is nothing in it to enthuse me. Therefore, I have no choice but to express my total opposition to the entire proposed new Constitution. The only good parts of the new Constitution are those which were copied from our present Constitution, and if we reject the new in its entirety, we will still retain the good in our present document. Since the convention adjourned, I have spent endless hours going over the work of the convention, and I have concluded that I cannot in good conscience recommend the new Constitution to the people of Montana. That was your statement. Yeah.
That's what I... See, now, had they not went out and started hard selling, I wouldn't have... in fact, I didn't do a whole lot. Yeah. I didn't try to kill it.
Yeah.
Which I could have, I guess. But anyway...
Were you joined by other delegates?
You know, in opposition?
Yeah.
I was pretty much on my own, I think. I don't know. I did it by... I never got involved with trying to promote the thing or not promoting it. Let's see... Well, I told you that they were hard-working delegates.
Yeah. Were there any members of the Constitutional Convention that especially stand out in your memory?
Oh, there was a whole bunch of them, but... Let me explain a little bit on this first.
Okay. Good.
Okay, this was the official ballot. Now, the Constitutional Convention, in its wisdom, said that for anything to pass, it had to get 50% of the votes cast plus one. That means that if 40 people voted for it and 39 voted against it and 50 people voted all together, it'd lose. You get that?
Yeah.
Okay. And the reason they did that was because of these added, which authorized gambling.
Yeah, there were three side issues: capital punishment, gambling, and the unicameral legislature.
That's right.
Yeah.
Unicameral went down. And so when they voted for gambling, well, it won easily. But the people in the Constitution figured that there was a good chance it did go under. They wouldn't make it because more people would vote for this, the main Constitution, and they wouldn't bother with that other.
Yeah.
But it turned out to be opposite. And then the same thing with the death penalty. About, what, 2-3 or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay, the outcome was that when the votes were kind of counted, the main Constitution didn't get 50% plus one of the votes cast. It got more than half the votes that was cast for it, but not the ones that like was set up where they had to get of the total votes taken.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. But anyway, it was decided by the courts that it had passed.
Yeah, by a 3-2 decision in the state Supreme Court.
Yeah.
A kind of a tortured decision, as I recall, too, yeah.
Well, it was as plain as a nose on your face because we made it that plain in this Constitutional Convention.
Yeah.
That's what it'll be. But I know good and well that the people didn't figure that it would be the Constitution that could fail.
Yeah. Yeah, that was an unusual development. I agree with you. Yeah, I agree. What are your recollections of Graybill, who was the president of the Constitutional Convention?
Well, he ran for Congress.
Against Benton, I think.
Yeah, could be.
Yeah.
Anyway, he got beat, and he was kind of a sour guy. But when it come to the Constitutional Convention, he did one tremendous job. I was a floor leader on that. And it was my job to instruct delegates how to conduct themselves on the floor. And all it amounted to was to get recognized and only one person speak at a time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I impressed it on them because I said, Mrs. Durkee, who was the bookkeeper,
yeah.
if two people spoke, she couldn't write it down.
Sure.
So if you want to be heard, you...
Yeah.
Even Kelleher and Hilliker finally got the message.
Kelleher and Bob Kelleher and George Hilliker, CONCON delegates, were both pretty talkative, is that right?
Oh, yeah. And one's a professor and the other's an attorney, and they were proud of themselves. But anyway, we finally got, and I set up the committee rooms, and I said the chairman, and next to the chairman will set the vice chairman. When you have a meeting, you'll introduce everybody. You'll take the proponents first and let them speak. And when they get through, if there's a question, you go around the room. And once you establish this pattern, everybody will do it. The people that are coming to visit will know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And so that's the way it was.
Now, Joe, we've talked a little bit about lobbyists. Were lobbyists involved in the Constitutional Convention? Were business interests and so on represented before the committees in the Constitutional Convention?
Yeah, they were. They were there, and I think they set them on the outside hall.
Were they discouraged from being too actively involved? Were the delegates discouraged from interacting with them?
I can't really remember, but I know I brought a couple of lobbyists in to sit by me. Well, why don't I lighten up a little bit and tell you a little story?
Good.
All right. Supposedly, I'm a real liberal. The only person I know that's more liberal than me is Dorothy Eck. So, we josh about it. But this day, I said to Marion Erdman, I said, Marion, I got her. I got her today. She said, you have. I said, yeah. So when Dorothy got there, I leaned across Marion's desk and I said, Dorothy, I want to ask you something. And what? I said, you're so liberal. I said, how do you feel about free love? She said, your place or mine.
Oh.
I lost again.
Well, she called your bluff on that one, didn't she?
You know, those ladies were sharp.
Yeah.
They were capable, and they were determined in the Constitutional Convention. As far as work, they put out a lot of work.
I'm getting in my interviews some what I guess amounts to some conflicting information on whether the business community in Montana, whether you describe them as lobbyists or whatever, were involved in the Constitutional Convention or very involved or not. And I've had a couple of different people tell me that they were discouraged from being there, that there was a sort of a feeling that the delegates shouldn't associate much with lobbyists, and that there was that lobbyists kind of felt unwelcome there. I've picked that up, and then I've also picked up, heck no, they were lobbyists, were there all the time. What do you think about that?
Well, it's true. The lobbyists weren't, they were kind of ostracized, and for a better word. But I had a couple of lobbyists come, I brought them in and set them down beside me. They couldn't hardly throw them out.
Yeah.
But they wasn't... They wanted to do this job all by themselves.
Yeah.
See?
Did that idea come from Graybill, pretty much?
I think so. Now,
you say they wanted to do it by themselves, or
well, the delegates.
Yeah. Okay.
The delegates were eager.
Yeah.
And they were movers. They wanted to get the job done. Now, one thing that I did do, they wanted. They set us in alphabetical order to keep us from getting involved in politics.
Yeah.
They thought that everything should be voted on, roll call vote. And I got up and I said, don't do that. Don't. If you want a roll call vote, ask for it. Otherwise, you're gonna spend all your time with roll call votes.
That's
just
right.
On motion to adjourn.
Yeah, that was good advice.
Yeah. And anyway, when I get disgusted with them, shut it off. Man.
I don't know if I can, Joe.
Okay.
Tell me after it's over if you don't want to see.
Well, I can tell you anyway.
Okay.
See. Anyway, when they get carried away and things weren't going my way, why, once in a while I'd just get up and call for a roll call vote. What it meant is $125 from Reed Durkee. Without doing anything.
Yeah.
And it made me feel good.
Oh, see? Yeah, I wish she was a good gal. Well, that was probably a good deed. Probably a good deed.
Yeah. When I was department commander of the VFW, and Durkee was my quartermaster, and he was also in the Senate when I was first in the House, and he was very capable.
Yeah.
Very.
Bob Durkee was a legislator from Haver, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was in the Senate.
Yeah.
And he was very capable, like I said.
I am curious, are we done any more on the Constitutional Convention?
Well, I can't really think of anything.
Let me just mention a couple of names. Mean Ann Robinson.
Well, she was a fireball young lady. She could hold her own. She was dedicated. I think she became a legislator.
She's an attorney in Missoula.
Yeah. Well, she had lots of ability.
Otto Habedank.
Yeah, Otto. I barely remember him, but I can't remember what resolution he was on. What?
Marshall Murray.
Yeah, a nice gentleman.
You served in the legislature with him too.
Yeah. He was a nice guy. He was. He's the kind of guys I liked. In other words, they aren't backbiters or anything. They're just good. Friends back and forth.
Bob Campbell.
Oh, he gives me hell all the time. I got a letter from him. he likes to promote these get-togethers for the Constitutional Convention.
Yeah.
And I can't think of anything I'm less interested in. We ain't gonna change nothing. Just,
yeah.
But they like to get together and tell
sure.
how great they are. See?
Yeah.
So
you haven't been going to the reunions?
No, I don't go to the reunions. So anyway, he called me up from Fort Benton. I want to get a room for you. You get here. I said, don't get no room for me. If I come, he said, the rooms will be taken. I said, that's fine. I'll go to Great Falls. But don't get, anyway, he called me up a couple days later and madder than hell because I didn't come and take that room, see.
Yeah.
I said, I told you I was going to Great Falls. So the one I got here is announcing the next convention.
Was there any speech that anybody gave during the Constitutional Convention or anything that still stands out in your memory?
Oh. There was a Mrs. What's her name?
Cross?
Cross.
Louise Cross?
Yeah, she was a pretty capable.
Her
lady.
Name's come up before. What's memorable about her?
Well, she was after something. I can't remember now what it was. But whatever it was, she was dedicated to it.
Yeah.
It's some kind of rights.
I see. She was real concerned about protecting the environment. Wasn't that her big
Well,
cause?
It could have been. I
yeah.
can't. Boy, this is quite a few years ago. I can't remember. You know.
Joey.
And I got to adjourn at Sidai anyway.
Oh, you did. You because as the floor leader, you got to make the motion to adjourn at Sidai.
Yeah, yeah.
You mentioned Fred Robinson, and you know, I had thought when I came here today, I hadn't remembered that he was from this area. But of course, the Fred Robinson Bridge is named for him, and he was a prominent legislator for I don't know
many years,
20, 30 years, I think, or probably more over there. And I'm just curious to know. You know, we talked about the Anaconda Company in this old era of corporate dominance and that sort of thing. If you ever saw anything you could point to, anything concrete that would kind of connect Fred Robinson to the Anaconda Company's power structure?
I don't think I could.
It was just a gut feeling on your part that he was a part of the
I never see him vote against him.
Yeah.
That's
could you, you know, there's an old saying that the birds of a feather flock together. So did you see Fred with other people, like-minded people, frequently doing things together that would lead you to believe that he was a part of that group?
He was a senator and I was in the House, so
yeah.
I probably never seen too much.
Well, I'm thinking like at the lobby of the Placer Hotel as an example, where you guys would be over there just kind of milling around, going in and out of the water.
You got to realize that Fred has got a little age on him by this time.
Yeah.
And so he isn't, as I recalled, he wasn't as active as I was going to these places. I didn't figure that the lobbies could corrupt me, so I went.
Remember Jerry Anderson?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He wrote a poem about me. I got it in there someplace. We used to kid back and forth.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so he wrote this poem about me.
Just a clever, funny little poem?
Yeah.
He's a clever guy.
Yeah.
Now, was that read at one of the mock legislative sessions, do you suppose? He did mock sessions, I think.
It could have been. Yeah. I can't remember. Anyway, he gave it to me when I was through. But yeah, I knew Jerry. I've seen Jerry several times. He is aging a little.
Yeah,
though.
But he's still over there, still an active
lobbyist.
Oh,
still lobbying, yeah. You'd think he had it made by now, wouldn't you?
Yeah, and he probably does, but I think he likes to stay busy. He likes to stay involved.
Yeah.
Well, look, we've just got a couple minutes left on the tape. Is there anything you'd like to say in conclusion? Anything we've left out of the interview maybe that we should have covered?
Well, all I can say is an experience that I'm glad I had. I wouldn't particularly want to do it again, but it was enjoyable when it was taking place.
Well, I appreciate your public service, and I know the people of Montana do too. And I appreciate your contributing to the State Historical Archives, Joe. And, as you know, this interview will be placed on file, and historians will be able to refer to it in the future.
I do have a request.
Yeah.
Please correct my language.
Okay, all right. Well, I'm not sure I can do that. I think what's going to go in the record is just what's been recorded here today. But
is that right?
It's good. It's good. It's and much appreciated. Thank you, Joe.